Hey, welcome back, Third Year Scratch. I am Alan, and I am glad to be here. Thanks for listening last week. A lot of cool stuff from the Nathan Wetherington interview. That was fun. That was a lot of good, and a lot of good response about that. What an interesting dude. I'm doing this one is with Sarah Olmsted of Rose Arc, R-O-W-S-A-R-C. And she has a new record and a really talented singer-songwriter from the L.A. area. But so I did a FaceTime call with her, and that turned out pretty cool. Audio is better than I thought it would be, but it does kind of flange in and out here and there, and you'll hear that. I'm working it out. You guys will, it'll all be fine. It's fine. Life and Times has shows coming up at the end of July for celebrate the 10-year repressing of Tragic Boogie, our second record. And those sound awesome, engineered or mastered and engineered by Jason Livermore. We recorded it, Eric and I recorded it in my basement in Kansas City, and then we sent the tracks off, 8 of the 12 tracks, to Jason Livermore to mix, and he did a fucking great job. And then Eric and I mixed the last 4 on there, or some 4 in there. And so yeah, those dates are at the end of July. First one is July 25th in Minneapolis at the Hook and Ladder. Previously it was at Mortimer's. It's not at Mortimer's now. It is at the Hook and Ladder with Technician. And 26 is at the Record Bar with Other Americans and Slights. And then 27th is in Tolono, just south of Champaign in Illinois, with Centaur, Matt Talbot's extra side project. And then the 28th is in Chicago at the Metro, and we're opening for Jawbox, whoever that is. I don't know. They keep saying the name, and I guess I'm supposed to know who that is. I'm kidding. They're a big deal for us, and Jay Robbins is very important in my development. In fact, I had him mix 4 of the 8 songs that are going to go on this project record that I have with Ian Prince, and a really amazing drummer from Minneapolis. He was in a band, Houston, and Story of the Sea, of course, and now he plays with a band called Porcupine. And Katie, keep it down. And then the other 4 songs are of this two-piece are going to be mixed by Brian Hanna, are currently being mixed by Brian Hanna, and he lives in Minneapolis. He's an engineer, very well known from that area. So we're still trying to find a name. And then Shiner is tracking, and I'm working on some vocals and stuff. And Shiner tracked, actually. We recorded 6 or 7 songs, and so look for that at some point. Hopefully it's holds up to the tradition. And so now, yeah, Sarah Olmsted is the singer and songwriter in Rose Arc. And she paired with Jason Gagofsky, one of my buddies from here in Chicago, who's a very well-known drummer. And he plays with a band called Sweet Cobra, which is a pretty heavy band. They generally play with bands like Pelican and Russian Circles and Cloakroom. And you'll find the guys in Mastodon wearing their shirt and that kind of stuff. So it's definitely kind of an incongruous pairing between Sarah and Jason, but he's perfect for this, and really he has a very wide musical palette. So, but the conversation is just with Sarah, and she's a super interesting lady and human, and really driven and really articulate with a lot of great insights. And we talk about, you know, all kinds of shit. But it was a really wonderful conversation. So please dig this. I'm going to play a couple of the songs that Eric and I recorded for this record. It was done at our studio, which is outside of Chicago, and it took about a year, but it was a really cool, fun recording process that was difficult at times. There's a lot of cooks in the kitchen, but I think the final product is super worth it. And so I will she's got a couple new videos and is planning a bunch of shows. This interview is a couple months old now, so it's a little past its prime, but you know what, It'll be fine. And I'm going to play a couple songs from the new record at the end of this. One is Some Days and the other is High on the Tide. So definitely stick around for that. So this is me and Sarah Olmsted talking through the tubes of the internet. Amen. Wait, this is how you look when you're back from a run?
No, I did take a shower because I felt pretty nasty. Yeah. It was like the, once the sweat dries and it starts to get that crystally feeling.
I know it. I know that.
It's time to slough it off.
I get it. How you been?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Kind of nuts, but pretty good. How about you?
Yeah, what's nuts?
Well, the combination, having the record come out and then getting everything ready for the show, which we were collaborating with a gallery here in LA.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of just being a show, it's also like
an event.
It's an event. Yeah. So doing all this stuff, like there'll be some sculptural elements and then there'll be like projected on us while we're playing this kind of multi-layered scrims.
That's crazy. So that
when you project onto them, it kind of aberrates the image in a certain way, uh-huh. Which is going to be fun. Oh, let me turn this off so it doesn't mess with the audio.
Who's in charge of all that?
Me.
Really? Yeah. And so does this kind of like dovetail with your normal job? Remind me what you do.
Okay, so for my day job, my make money job, I run a business with my family where I sell children's goods, like nature and imagination based goods for kids. So things to get kids outside and enjoying the world and sort of using their brains a little bit. The idea was that we started about 10 years ago and I realized it was kind of hard to change an adult's mind. So if you give kids really awesome tools and teach them how to be curious and engaged in the world, then they convince the parents, and then in 20 years maybe you have people that are a little bit more engaged with the world, more concerned about the environment, more connected to each other.
And who started the company? Your folks?
Actually it was my sister, my mom, and I, and we started it about 10 years ago, and it's been kind of a trial by fire because I'd never been an entrepreneur before. And
right.
It was kind of one of those things because I was making visual art back then where I knew that I was going to need a career that had some flexibility to time. And also, you know, with visual art, it's the same, similar to music in the sense that you can't always count on a regular paycheck and you've got to figure out how to make it work, but also still make time to do the things that you love to do. And so you kind of have to run the two job gamut, which I know that like we're all familiar with.
Yeah, I thought that's just what you had to do.
I know. I was talking to someone the other day and I was like, you only have one job?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I think that's a vanishing thing. I mean, that's part of what this whole thing is about, honestly, is like how are we, you know, what are we doing and how do we what inspires us to continue to make music and make art even when we're not making tons of money and, you know, and everybody has different reasons for it, you know, but, and so what's the name of the company?
Imagine Childhood is the name of the company.
.com.
Yeah. And so we've been doing that for the better part of a decade.
Were you involved with like, you create the product? Some of the stuff.
No, I mean, some of the things we do, we have some art kits and craft kits that we've made over the years. For the most part, we just function as a retailer. So we, you know, find great products and find great companies and share those things. We have, you know, we've helped other companies in the past. I think actually when we recorded the record with you, I was in the middle of doing a thing we did. We did a project actually with the White House when Michelle Obama was in there, and we helped them put together a garden kit for their store and for some special events that they do. So
you mean it wasn't like, for Melania and for Donald? I can't believe that.
Yeah, you know,
That's crazy.
They weren't as into the gardening thing. You know, they're just dirt and environmental things.
They wanted to pave the garden. Yeah.
So, what do they want? They want to pave paradise and put up a parking lot?
I heard that one. I heard that original recording the other day, Joni Mitchell's version, and it's so and it's so stripped down. I think I'm used to the Counting Crows version. Well, it's a Joni Mitchell song.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's super like super stripped down and cool.
Well, I actually haven't heard the Counting Crows version. I thought there was a more stripped down version than the
no,
the Joni. Yeah.
No, it just kind of is what it is. The Counting Crows version is kind of dog shit, but it's also kind of catchy and good.
Yeah.
As
yeah.
those things go. It's a hit for a reason. They chose a good song to cover.
For sure. Yeah.
So what's we finished the record. That was a lot of work. Probably a long time coming. I helped you record and make it happen. I was a little part of the process. Me and Eric.
You guys are a big part of the process. You guys were wonderful. And
how did you thank you? How did you meet Gago originally?
So Jason and I worked together when I lived in Chicago, and I worked at the Field Museum.
That's right. And
yeah,
that makes sense. I find it such a strange pairing, you two making music and stuff. He's such a scuzz, you know? I don't think people know that he's from like Sweet Cobra. Some people do. And to know Sweet Cobra, you know, is they're scuzzy and awesome, but like, it seems like an incongruous pairing, but it seems like it's totally worked.
Yeah, I think sort of the fact that we came from very different places in music, but also I think one of the things we bonded on early when we first met was similar taste in music. Mm-hmm. So, I wasn't so much on the heavy side, but he, you know, like he likes a very broad spectrum of music, and he's an audiophile without limits. So
yes, he is.
I think, you know, we bonded over those things, and something that I've always liked in life and in art is when you have kind of two things from very opposite sides of the spectrum, mm-hmm. and then they challenge each other a little bit, and mm-hmm. it's not all sweetness. There's some dirt and some mud in the sweet, you know?
That's the good stuff though.
Yeah.
I think that's the best. That's what makes it kind of work out. What was the stuff you guys bonded on?
Probably the first one was Jillian Welt, mm-hmm. and her stuff. He's really a big fan of hers. And I like her as well. You know, that and a lot of different stuff. Yeah. I think probably more back then when we first met, I was kind of in a folk zone a little bit more. So it was a lot of stuff in that.
And
in
he was kind of able to introduce you to more, probably more noisy stuff a little bit that you probably weren't familiar with.
Yeah. And then there was also lots of ambient stuff that we bonded over, mm-hmm. like Brian Eno and Bundy K. Brown and, mm-hmm. you know, stuff kind of in that zone of that stuff, which was great. And yeah, he did the classic thing when we first met where he just took my iPod and filled it up with a bunch of stuff.
For real?
Yeah.
He and I went and saw, the Cactus Blossoms up in Evanston at Space. Uh-huh. It was amazing. Do you know those guys? You know what that is?
I don't know those guys.
It's like
I need
super
to check them out.
Haunted. I think they were on the first couple episodes of Twin Peaks, the reboot.
Oh.
So it's kind of like got that haunted Everly Brothers vibe to it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's so good. These two cats that sing up front are just like crooning together. And then the band is like stand-up bass. And just like the other players are just like killers. And they're, I think, from Minneapolis or something, but they're doing really well. They're awesome.
Oh, I'll have to check them out. That sounds great.
You love them. That's Gago, Jason Gagowski, drummer in Sweet Cobra. Is like, I find him like, I think that's really cool that you guys decided to do this. And then we worked on it over about a year or something, different sessions. Yeah.
I think so. It took about a year because we were, you know, I live in LA and you guys are all in Chicago, and then just sort of combining, figuring out schedules and getting everything to work out.
Right. LA is West Coast, right? I always forget.
It's like kind of West-ish.
Okay. Flyover country for me. So I don't, on my way to Japan.
Yeah. One of these days you'll come here.
I'll stop in.
Yeah. So it took about a year, I think, and from that first session where mm-hmm. I just sort of shakily played all of my skeleton songs mm-hmm. to you guys.
Yeah, so that's how does that work out? You you're not like a classically trained musician, and right, in any way, or did you just teach yourself how to play all these things?
There's a little, there's a nugget in there of some training in that I played cello from when I was three, or not when I was three, when I was in third grade until eighth grade.
That helps.
So, yeah, so I did have some basis.
That's cool.
A relationship to music and reading music and, you know, theory and some of that a little bit, but never, as far as guitar and keys and everything, that was all, that's just, I just needed something to be able to sing to.
Yeah.
So I'd play very, very simple things and figure it out as I went. And I don't count myself as any sort of great musician on any particular instrument, but I can get by and enough to sing over.
I guess, yeah. But there's some of it's like really well played, you know, a lot of it's really well played. And I'm just like struck by, of course, but I think I'm just struck by how like cool the songs are and how solid the songs are. On kind of like very simple premise, you know, I think that's part of like the beauty of what you do is that they're simple tunes and the chord structure is not trying to, it's not about that. It's about the voice and kind of, and the lyric and this kind of haunted aspect to it, which I think is super appealing about the whole thing. And what drew me to, I was just like, I remember recording you and just being like blown away. And then you harmonize and that's doubling great. Your voice. I'm serious. It's a big deal.
That's very, very kind of you to say. Like, wow. I felt really lucky to be, especially coming into the project in the place I was in sort of my process of dealing with my own fear around the issue of playing music and doing everything else, and to come into a space where you guys were just so encouraging and welcoming and excited and did such a great job of capturing those moments too, which is a hard thing to do sometimes, you know, it's like to get that. Mm-hmm. To get that the feeling of the moment and not have it feel tin like it's in a can somehow. And you guys did a great job.
Good, thank you. Well, we just always press record. Always press record. As soon as you walk in, you never know. It might just be some gold.
It's true.
Well,
it's true.
For us, honestly, recording people, we really enjoy getting that moment. There's so many people now that can record and get, you know, more like compressed, high quality, crispy sounds than like that's not necessarily what we do. I mean, we get performances from people, and I think that's the best thing I can offer people, because I think that's what's missing from a lot of current music right now and for the past 30 years. I mean, everything's too well produced, or, you know, not everything, but a lot of stuff you hear. And I think the best stuff are just performances, like Tom Petty records. I hate to always like reference that, but like,
but it's true. It's true, because the thing is we relate more to the imperfection than perfection. When you feel the human element, then you connect to it in a way where it is immediately somatic. It's in your body. You don't question it. And I think there's an issue right now that's happening in this world where everything is so perfect, and you know, every recording is perfect and every image has a perfect filter on it, and nothing is gritty or dirty or a little off in some way.
Even if it is,
it's highly curated, you know, everything's so self-reflected in this intense space of narcissism that, you know, these platforms cause. And then, you know, you have to use those platforms because that's how you connect to people, and that's you know how the world is. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. It's like, you know, the tool you need is also the tool that hurts you a little bit.
It has to be used, you know, judiciously. I wonder if we as a society kind of have to go to that point in order to see that we have to like dial back or something. I don't fucking know.
I think so. You know, everything comes in a pendulum. I think first generations of anything, if you think about, like, I don't know, people when they first had a lot of alcohol for the first time, there's a lot of alcoholics, and then you realize like how to handle that new drug.
We have the opportunity now to fix every note and to fix every blemish, like you're saying. And so maybe our instinct as humans is to fix it.
Yeah.
You know, especially on yourself, to fix it all the way to the end until you realize that you've achieved it, and now it's completely like been whitewashed and banal, you know?
Yeah.
And it loses its sense of character. And I think your record is full of character and cool shit.
Well, thank you. Ah, I really appreciate absolutely. That. It's imperfect, but in the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to, the videos are awesome. Did you do those?
Yeah. Crazy. So the first one was actually edited by my friend, Michael Robinson, who's an amazing filmmaker.
That's high on the tide.
No, actually, some days.
Oh, okay.
Some days was not edited.
Some days was the first one with the mirrors. Right.
With the mirrors and the stuff, and that was kind of like low. It was a one day shoot running around in alleys in my neighborhood, and you know, like doing some stuff. And then a friend of mine who's an amazing filmmaker and does a lot of collage style projects and just makes beautiful work edited it for me. And then High on the Tide was a long process because I had the image of it in my head a long time ago, and then trying to figure out the shoot and trying how to figure out how to do it on a low budget.
Looks like it was shot out where MASH was filmed or something back in the day, like out in the Hollywood, like the north of town, north of LA.
It was actually shot near that place Pappy and Harriet's out by Joshua Tree. They play it there. There's a lot of music that goes through there and other things, but it's kind of near Joshua Tree and Pioneer Town zone. And I kind of scouted around for a long time and we found that spot. And then, my sister-in-law went to school with this great cinematographer, and he was game to come out and do it. So it was just Trevor, my husband, Trevor and I, and Niraj, who's now playing with us as well. Niraj Kane. Who's
I've met him.
Yeah, he's in Hope Conspiracy.
Yeah, well, I think we met at a Life and Time show at, or it was a Shiner show at Echo.
That's right. Yeah. He came with me.
And has he always played? Have you guys been musically connected, you and Niraj?
We actually didn't connect until Jason came out here a number of years ago.
Okay.
And Jason has been friends. Actually, fun trivia fact, Sweet Cobra is named after Niraj because Niraj was in Sweet, the very first iteration of Sweet Cobra.
Ah.
And that was his nickname, like way back when.
It actually has some sort of meaning to it, so I'm going to have to find out what that is. Why he's
this, because he's just like a little sweet cobra. So he has a very long history with Jason. They've known each other for 20 some years, and like he's from Chicago originally as well. And so we kind of met, I think, when Jason was out here for one of the trips. He had just told a bunch of friends he was going to be at a bar, and then everybody showed up, and so I met some of his friends that lived here. And then I was just wanting to kind of play music with someone here, and we just kind of started noodling around on some stuff and started writing some new songs. And then he really liked the record that Jason and I made, and it just seemed to be a good fit. And so then he kind of naturally and organically like came into the fold as well. So he's playing, he's playing with us, and doing all the live shows, and then I'll be part of future records.
Is there another record besides the one I've worked on you with? Worked on it with?
Not yet. We have a bunch of songs.
He was he's down with this one that you were talking about. He knew the songs in earlier iterations because you guys have done several different. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how long do you think was the process for recording the whole, like writing? Have you been writing for 5 years on it or something, you think, picking at it? That's how it goes for me.
You mean from like when I wrote the songs until the record came out?
Mm-hmm. Or like, until the record was done.
Yeah, I'd say before we came out to you, I think I had, the first time we came and recorded, I think I had probably like 5 skeletons that we put together and kind of recorded the bass, the basic instrument and vocals for. Mm-hmm. And those probably came to me in fits and starts over a couple of years.
Yeah.
And it was before I kind of convinced myself that, when I came to make the record, I basically set a trap for myself because I was like, if I make the record, I will have to figure out what the damage is in my brain that is keeping me from doing something that I love so much. Uh-huh. And it worked. It forced me to have to deal with it.
Yeah, it's really a dance to have to force yourself to make time for art and for creative things that you want to do. But it takes a lot of fucking time.
Yeah.
To commit to do something or to not, because like there's a lot of people I think that have songs out there, but they go, oh, I don't know who I do it with, or I got to make a corny, I got to play live, I got to do this. Ah, fuck it. I don't want to deal with it, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I cut you off from, you're talking about the video shoot for High on the Tide.
Oh yeah.
So did you make, it's kind of a super futuristic kind of vibe to it out in the desert and like,
yeah.
Did you create all that stuff? Because I know you're handy too, aren't you?
I am pretty handy. I've always been a builder and a maker. When I was making visual art, I used to make sculpture. And I built my parents' house with my siblings from scratch. And
So you and your brothers and sisters built your parents' house.
Yeah, we were all in college at that point, and they bought 40 acres of land, and we moved out onto it and lived in random different dwellings on the land, hexagonal army tent, trailer.
It was a yurt.
Basically, it was like that kind of situation, and built the barn first, put all the stuff in the barn, and then built the house. They still live there.
What kind of like, I don't know, are they kind of like free spirits, your folks, or are they professionals, yeah, or what did they do?
They've always been kind of serial entrepreneurs in one way or another.
So not necessarily just one thing has defined them.
Yeah, a lot of different stuff. I mean, my dad, I think part of my very strong interest in music and kind of, it's interesting because my dad was a radio DJ in the 70s, and then in the late 70s and early 80s, he had this business called Oz Productions, which he called foreground music instead of background music. And he had a whole white paper about it. It was very serious business. And he would go into restaurants and businesses and all these other sorts of things. And this was before playlists or anything like that happened. You know, it was way back in the day. And he would curate the perfect mixtape for the people who like to go to those particular venues. And then he'd bring in a reel of, you know, actual 2-inch, you know, like full like tape. And he would get, this is before people were doing, you know, pay for play and actually attributing to artists and doing it properly. Mm-hmm. And he was part of a whole crew of people at the beginning that kind of helped to set that up of like, okay,
you're going to use these artists and they're going to get paid for it. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're not going to use Muzak where we rip off the song and change it, or do whatever it is. And it's just crappy elevator music in the background. We're going to get the real stuff, do it on the level, and then, you know, put it out there. So as a result of that, he had, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 records.
That's a lot of artists. That's a lot of crazy shit.
We moved those things many times. Oh, they're heavy.
Yeah. That's crazy. That's interesting because that really kind of predates, you know, like if you walk into Longman and Eagle now, I mean, mm-hmm, that's a curated list, you know, but it's just off the iPod or something, or sometimes it's our Spotify list, you know, but the listening intent is the same. It's very much foreground kind of music. People, when it comes on, they know it. It's maybe that whole ship has, maybe the whole Muzak ship has sailed because of like folks like your dad. That's interesting.
I think so. Yeah. Like with you can curate so easily, mm-hmm, and you can have the stuff that you really like and it can be right there. But yeah, so because of that, I think I have this interesting relationship with music where it's untethered. I don't, you know, some people, it's like Jason could tell you whoever wrote a specific song on a certain date on a thing. My dad could tell you all that stuff too. I can't, but if I hear a certain chord progression or if I hear something, I can play. I know exactly like what pocket it's in, but I can't tell you who did it or how they did it. Then there's part of it that I kind of like because I have this world of music that's you know, a broad listening spectrum in my head, but it's not tethered to the idea of who it is and when it happened and what's going on. So I don't have a good or bad association with a sound. I just have a like, oh, that's interesting. Or that's
almost like childlike in a certain way, and like the way you used, well, you know, the way you used to hear stuff before you knew it was the Beatles or before you knew it was James Taylor or Carole King or somebody, you just knew they were awesome songs and you knew, you didn't know to hate it because it was somebody you were supposed to hate or somebody was like, you know, I didn't know Rock and Roll All Night was Kiss for a long time. It was just like some song. You know, I thought it might have been Three Dog. I didn't know who the fuck it was. I want to rock and roll. You know, it's like,
yeah,
hell yeah, I want totally. to. It just is like, but so you made all the stuff for the video in the desert, just so we don't leave that.
Yeah. So I built the boat and I made the costumes and then we came up with the concept, and then I built the boat and made the costumes. And then Chris Turriello, who's a great cinematographer, came out and he shot it. And then he and I co-edited it together.
I'm so thoroughly convinced how important your director of photography is, whoever shoots something. It just is like the ultimate in making something look super pro, you know? I mean,
it has to, yeah, they have to, and you have to be on the same page. And he was just so wonderful and, you know, very into, you know, I had all these nerdy ideas on stuff, and he was very game for the whole process.
Oh, really?
No, he was game. Yeah. He was game to play around. We actually shot a lot of it with, and this was his idea and contribution, was we shot it on a digital camera, but we shot it with 16 millimeter Bolex lenses. So it was real glass, and you get the real refraction and all of the optics and light that happens.
Definitely has that analog feel to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm picturing you either assembling that boat on site or driving it out there in some fashion and getting it set up out there.
Yeah. So in true, nerdy maker fashion, I built it in a way where it comes apart and all collapses, and then you can put it all in the back of the car.
You can reuse it if you wanted to.
You can. it's actually going to make an appearance in the record release show.
Oh, good.
Yeah. But it's not in the actual space where we're performing, but there's a few different parts of the gallery. Mm-hmm. So there'll be some things there, but yeah. So it comes apart into pieces. There's like a base plate and then the ribs, and then you connect all those. And then the mirrors come on and off, because we had to shoot. There's some shots where it's just the boat frame, and so we had to shoot it that way. And then we had to put the mirrors on, in order to shoot the other scenes.
I see that. It looks like an extraordinarily hot day. Was it not?
Yes.
Okay, because it looks like you look fresh out there. Was it just a one-day shoot kind of thing?
It's a two-day shoot. The second day, I could barely keep my eyes open because I'd burned my eyeballs.
How come you didn't bring no sunglasses? You got to bring your sunglasses and pop them off when you shoot.
I mean, I did have that, and I actually had an umbrella over me too to try to do it in between. But there was just so much time where you're walking around and you're actually shooting, and you can't do anything about it. And then I also, because I'm not a person that wears a lot of makeup on a regular basis, and I don't know how all that stuff goes. Like, I had to watch a tutorial to figure out how to put it on. But I put sunscreen on before the rest of the makeup. But then at some point, you know, sunscreen loses its effectiveness.
Right.
We didn't have time to like wipe off all the makeup and put more sunscreen on and put everything back on. So you just keep going. I actually sent Jason a photo after the end of the shoot where I looked like a tomato, like a burned eyeball. My eye got burned because the whole montage in the beginning where, I'm blocking the sun with my hand. Uh-huh. Well, to get the proper perspective for the camera, you're not actually blocking the sun with your hand. Like, the sun's hitting your face, but the camera makes it look like it's being blocked by your hand. So you're just having to kind of try to stare slightly south of the sun, but essentially into it. It was kind of an intense day, but
that's
fun.
Rough.
Yeah.
It was fun. It turned out fucking amazing.
Thank you.
The melody for some days, I think, is just probably the most familiar to me. I know it, but then I thought, I don't know it. It just is like one of those melodies is so timeless, and it's a circular kind of, you know, kind of comes back around on itself every time. I think that was one of the first ones that I heard. It was just like super compelling, and it was like, did you ever see the movie Ratatouille? You know, that Pixar movie where he eats the rat and he brings him back to something. He goes back in time and it's his mom.
But
it was like I had that feeling of like I've known this, and I don't know where it's from. It's really strange, but cool. I'm not suggesting in any way that you took it from anything.
I actually had that feeling a few times, where with certain songs where something feels so right mm-hmm. that you wonder where you're like, oh wait, this can't be. Mm-hmm. I think that is it.
Yeah.
Like I didn't make this because it feels yeah. so natural Who in my body.
This? Is this a thing? Like, yeah. You're plucking at it.
I think there's actually I hadn't seen it. It's not a new movie, but I just watched it recently. There's what's it called?
Human like Centipede. Maggie,
yeah, that one exactly. I think it's Crazy Heart.
Crazy Heart. Oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a scene in there. You know, he plays like a drunk old mm-hmm. songwriter. There's a scene where he's playing something, and the other character comes in and says, you know, like, oh, that's great. Where have I heard that before? And he's like, the good ones always make you feel like you heard them before.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think you know they probably are. Like we're all humans, so we echo. We mm-hmm. echo parts of sounds, and there's chords that make sense to you and feel good for certain reasons. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm sure that there's pieces and parts of things that have made me feel good in songs that come out in the things that I've made, you know, that just sort of go into the pot and come out and get churned in another way. And there's a sequence of mm-hmm. things that can make everything sort of tingle and ring out. I went to a friend's show the other day. He played three chords. And all of a sudden I was just like, what happened? What did you just do to me? Like I had to hide that I was crying because he was three chords in. And I was like, I don't know what happened, but it just reverberated in my body in a way that forced emotion out of me.
Oh shit. So yeah. Have you, I know those times. I really do. It always hits me. It hits me when I'm really tired. I tend to hit those things. If I'm driving on the roads, I'm like, and I'm really exhausted. Like a James mm-hmm. Taylor song will make me tear up mm-hmm. and whatever. I definitely have those. Have you? What are you going to do? Are you going to try to do some shows and go up the coast at some point?
Yeah.
Get Gago to make that happen.
I know. Yeah, we've got a bunch of different stuff that's kind of brewing and mm-hmm. and solidifying.
You're looking for a booking agent? This might be a good forum to.
Yeah, we wouldn't turn one down. That's
right.
For sure.
All right, I'll put them in touch with you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have a bunch of different stuff that's brewing.
Okay.
We've got this main show at the Pit on the 19th, mm-hmm. A week from today. It'll be a nice full moon and a nice record release show.
So April 19th. This may not go up for a few weeks, of course. But yeah.
It will have happened.
It will have happened. Yeah. It's so good. It was awesome.
It was a great show, wasn't it? It was the best.
The crowd was weeping. Oh. And then there was the pit, and the mosh pit.
Yeah. It was a mosh pit at a Rose Arc show. Uh-huh. That would be amazing.
So what does Rose Arc mean? What's the origins of Rose Arc? Rowsarc.
Yeah. So, you know how the band name thing goes, you kind of mull it around for a while and it's hard to find something that feels like mm-hmm. it's present for the moment, but open for the future.
Yes.
And I actually was over at the Getty Museum and I was wandering around. My good friend from my childhood friend was in town. He's an architect. And then my brother was in town. He's also an architect. And so we were wandering around. There's an artist named Robert Irwin, and he has a rose garden out there. And my childhood friend was saying like, oh, what do we think about rose? Like, you know, like rose and rose, there's a nice phonetic play on that and this other thing. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then we kept wandering around and my brother, who's an architect, was looking at the shape of the museum and everything that was happening there. And he was like, oh, what about Rose Arc? There's something that's, mm-hmm. you know, like the rows of arcs that were happening mm-hmm. in this space. And then it stuck in my head for some reason. The phonetics felt good. And then, mm-hmm. the next day when I woke up, it sort of clicked because I realized it was not only did it phonetically feel kind of good, but it was also essentially a universal geometry. Mm-hmm. So planets move around in rows of arcs, tree rings are in rows of arcs, sound moves out in rows of arcs.
It's a naturally occurring thing. It's beautiful. I get that. I struggled for a long time. I'm trying to think of a name for, I got a little two piece right now with another drummer from Minneapolis named Ian Prince. And so we're struggling. I've sent him what I think are the coolest names I can think of, and they don't resonate with him. And he sent me the names he thinks are cool. And I'm like, yeah, let's put in the hat. But neither of us are super. So we're still like, I don't even know what it fits. But like with Life and Times, I mean, we went for a long time trying to figure out something that would have, that would be, that felt right phonetically and like had that certain feel to it that flows off. Mm-hmm. And then also something that didn't define you for the future, that allowed you to like either grow in certain ways. It didn't define where you're going, you know, like if you're called, you know, Bloody Buzzsaw, you're whatever.
Exactly.
Or, you know, you might be, you're kind of, maybe that's the name for our two piece, actually. That might kind of keep it open. And then
that'd be kind of interesting for a two piece.
Bloody Buzzsaw.
Yeah. 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 No, it's really hard. I mean, I do not envy people who have children naming a child for
that's right.
the rest of their life. Like,
I didn't name my son Elliot till I saw him. I was like, Elliot.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you. That's the truth.
I know. It's a lot of pressure. Like, it's not just a band, it's a human.
I know. So what are you going to do for the rest of the day? You got to go to work? Do you work from home?
I work from home, which is the positive part of the kind of art, you know, music hustle is that
I love that hustle. I'm telling you, that's what this is all about. This is that dance.
Yeah, it definitely is a dance, and at times it can feel intense. At this particular moment, there's a confluence where everything's coming together, because as a retail business that sells children's goods, it's highly seasonal, and so, you know, we do most of our business around Christmas, obviously, but then we have kind of our last big push before the dry spell in the summer is Easter, which Easter and my record release show are happening within 2 days of each other.
Whee!
So it's been a hustle. And then also, as is evidenced by everything I've said during this interview, I have a tendency to decide to just do all of the things. Vernie, that's my dog. So, you know, it's,
that's not Trevor, right? That's not Trevor barking.
No. Yeah, sorry about that. Ready? Come here. He'll make a cameo on the podcast. It'll be great.
That's right. That's right. I'm going to play a couple songs here at the end here in just a second, more for everybody.
Oh, great.
So, yeah. Or maybe just one. Yeah. Maybe I'll do some days. That's my jam.
Yeah. That'd be awesome. But yeah, so the hustle, I think for me, having a job that is flexible, where even though I end up often working more than 40 hours a week, I can push those hours whenever I need to. Mm-hmm. So for instance, I mean, the other people that share our practice space think that it's crazy that we practice at 10 a.m. But actually, I can go in.
Yeah, you're fresh then probably, and you have a couple of free hours, and it's probably a better time.
Yeah, so I can go in, we can practice, there's no time constraint because nobody's going to be in the space after us, and there's nothing pushing. Mm-hmm. And then I can come home and I can work all afternoon and into the evening, mm-hmm. and, you know, push all those things around, so it makes it possible. Otherwise, if I had another job that wasn't like this, it would be a lot harder to find the time and the space.
I know it well. I spent a lot of time kind of lamenting not having one job, you know, because, you know, by this time in my life, I feel like there's that expectation, you know, I'm raising children, I'm married, and I've got this going on, but I still have, like, I'm still recording bands, I'm still playing Blue Man, I'm still bartending, and then we make money on the road, but that's only at the time, you know, and so it is a dance I wasn't sure, and a hustle I wasn't sure I would still be doing.
Yeah.
But I feel like a lifer, kind of like where I'm in at this point. I'm going to figure something out and continue to make art and create, you know?
Yeah.
And I try to imagine a life without it. I mean, and I can't imagine it. So
I tried it. I gave my, I did actually. I in the break, because I was very, you know, I went to art school and I was 100% in on all of that. And then kind of hit a point where I realized it wasn't exactly what I wanted to do. And I didn't realize at that point that everything that I was looking for in art was actually in music. And I just was using the wrong medium to express what I needed to express. But in the interim between before I figured that out, I stopped making anything for about 6 years. Mm-hmm. And it was not, everything started to kind of crumble in who I thought I was and what was going sure. on. And I didn't really even realize it for a while because I'm just a kind of highly productive person. Mm-hmm. And so I would just throw myself into all these other projects and with work and everything else. Mm-hmm. And I was doing things, but there was part of me inside that was dying. And I didn't realize that until I hit a wall. And I think my subconscious kind of threw this record out into the world as a ladder back to myself.
Wow.
You know, where I was like, you have to get out of this void and come back into where you are connected in a way that makes you fulfilled in the world. And
it's surprising how essential it is and how much it affects my daily sense of like self. Like when I create, it just like my day is brightened, you know, if I'm in the writing mode, like things are just yeah. like, as opposed to where if I'm just kind of like managing and cruising along, yeah. you know, and, mm-hmm. and I forget that I can still be creative in other ways and that's still cool, but it's not yeah. as, I don't get off as much, you know, if I'm like just building a wall in my basement, you know, I mean, I'd still enjoy that, you yeah. know, and like kind of, you know, doing build out stuff or whatever, but it's not as much as if I'm making.
Yeah. No, it doesn't come through. You know, I was being highly creative in a lot of ways between the business. And I wrote a book actually during that time, which was in like a totally different zone of life. And I was making all these things, but it wasn't expressing what I intrinsically needed mm-hmm. to express, you know, mm-hmm. and how I felt like I needed to connect and mm-hmm. what I needed to get out of me. And so that well just kept on churning inside and, mm-hmm. and the process became heavier and heavier and heavier until, you know, yeah, until you have to do something or it's not going to be a pretty picture.
Yeah, I understand. And yeah, it's almost, it happens kind of naturally as a reaction. And so last thing, what was your book about in a different realm and how did that happen?
That was kind of a confluence of a lot of different things. So when I started the business with my family, we didn't have any money for advertising. And previous to starting the business, the job that I did at the Field Museum of Natural History mm-hmm. was I worked as an interactives designer. So we would take kind of either dry or esoteric or complicated scientific material and find a way to present it in the form of a game or a video or an interactive element that you could play with in the exhibit, you know, all the stuff that if you go into one of those museums and you can push a button or play with something or mm-hmm. move a mechanical interactive, but that's the stuff that I worked on.
That's
so
great.
Kind of, you know, processing educational material into something fun. And so,
okay.
Yeah. You're basically taking a concept, you know, a dry concept that wouldn't be that interesting for somebody just to read in text and then introduce it in such a way, you know, ancient Americas, we came up with essentially kind of a video game, but not really where you could try out a bunch of different tools and function as a nation. And you could try like, oh, if you have a stick, can you kill a rabbit? Can you find it? You know, like basically how they develop tools, how you do these things. So you get to understand the reason why
yeah.
people did certain things mm-hmm. and, but it's in sort of a fun and interesting way that the learning gets sneaked, you know, stuck yeah. in with yeah. like spinach and a brownie kind of.
Surprise, you learned.
Yeah. So when we started the business, we started a blog because we had no money for advertising and mm-hmm. I just did similar type projects. And then we did that for a couple of years. And then out of the blue, a publisher reached out and said, you know, have you ever thought of writing a book? And I lied and said, of course.
Hell yes.
Always. Definitely. 100%.
That's fascinating. That's really fascinating.
Yeah. And yeah. Cool. And then 45,000 words later.
Oh my God. and how long did it take you? A year or more? A couple years?
Yeah. That was probably start to finish a 2-year project, a year and a half.
That's
yeah,
really
about
cool.
a year and a half. But yeah, so it's in a very different realm mm-hmm. and it's just projects and activities for kids, and, you know, things that get them connected to the natural world mm-hmm. and things that are kind of catalysts for creativity and exploration. But yeah, so that's highly creative, but it wasn't in the zone mm-hmm. where I needed to, whatever was inside of me needed to get out. And that's why I think I came back to music and to doing all those other things. Yeah.
Well, thank you for doing this, lady.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're a fascinating human, and I learn more and more as it goes along. Well, let's do a Life and Times in Rose Ark show in Chicago.
I think we should definitely do that.
All right.
That sounds like a great idea.
Okay. Well, it'll be a few weeks before this is out, and I'll let you know.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thanks so much.
Talk to you soon.
All right.
Later.
Bye, buddy.
Bye. See? She's great. Well, thank you so much for listening. As promised, here's The Jam's first song is High on the Tide. And then the next one is Some Days from Rose Ark.
Baby girl, you went and found keeps you warm. And if he can't, I'm sure he tries. Please come home. It's a false fight.